Bobby sent me an email, and all it said was, P wants to know if you'd like to come to Paisley Park tonight. P, of course, meaning Prince. But I had such a surreal moment because it was the top of the hour, 11 p.m., and here comes, you know, on the current, one of the tracks from Purple Rain, and I'm pulling into Paisley Park, and then Bobby is just standing outside waiting for me. And it quickly dawned on me that the two of us were the only people in the parking lot. This wasn't some kind of, you know, private party. This was going to be a meeting.
I bet everyone has a Prince story very similar to that one, don't you think? Maybe not. That is the voice of Andrea Swenson, and we will talk with her in just a matter of minutes here on Rock Conversations. Welcome, by the way, to Rock Conversations. I am the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll, otherwise known as Rob Bob. So here's my Prince story, because I'm sure we all have one, right? My Prince story is, I heard him on the radio a few times, I own a few of his albums, and I once, yes, only once, attended a concert by Prince. Sorry. My Prince stories are not very exciting, but I've always respected his music and loved the stories behind him and his music. And I think you will too, as we talk with Andrea Swenson. She, among other things, in addition to being a former DJ in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area on the FM station, The Current, she is also the host of the official Prince podcast and the author of Gotta Be Something Here. That's the rise of the so-called Minneapolis sound. Now I say so-called because, as she will point out, there are different opinions of what actually constitutes the Minneapolis sound. And in fact, there might even be a couple different, quote unquote, Minneapolis sounds. She's full of great stories, including one that involves Sound 80 Studios in Minneapolis. It is where, in the mid-70s, Bob Dylan came to re-record some tracks for Blood on the Tracks, his great album, one of my favorites. He wasn't quite happy with the original version, so he came to Minneapolis, recorded them, and about a year later, there was this gentleman named Prince who went into the same recording studios, Sound 80 Studios, to record his first album. How about that? A couple of housekeeping items before we get on with our conversation. Rock Conversations is available on Apple, Spotify, and other places where you get your podcast. And we ask that you please provide a review, either rank us or give us a little review if you like us. And even if you don't really like us, no pressure. But even if you don't like us, you can give us a review. Now, with that said, let's get to our rock conversation with Andrea Swenson.
Oh, let's go back. Let's go back. Let's go back again.
I think it was to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the release of Purple Rain that you interviewed Bobby Z, wrote a blog about it for The Current, where you were working at the time. And then I'll let you pick up the story from there because it gets pretty good.
So it was on the anniversary of Purple Rain coming out, and we published this story. We had little snippets of Bobby talking at the top of every hour on The Current, and we were playing tracks from Purple Rain, and it was like this whole event. And Bobby sent me an email, and all it said was, P wants to know if you'd like to come to Paisley Park tonight. P, of course, meaning Prince. And I said yes. And we set it up that afternoon that I was supposed to get out there at 11 p.m. So that was our date. I spent the next couple hours trying to figure out what on earth you wear to go meet Prince at Paisley Park. And then I drove out there, and I'll never forget, I had such a surreal moment because it was the top of the hour, 11 p.m., and here comes, you know, on The Current, one of the tracks from Purple Rain, and I'm pulling into Paisley Park, and then Bobby is just standing outside waiting for me. And it quickly dawned on me that the two of us were the only people in the parking lot. This wasn't some kind of, you know, private party. This was going to be a meeting. And as soon as I got out of the car, Bobby said, I think we hit a nerve. And my heart just dropped because all of a sudden I had this feeling like, am I being called to the principal's office? What is happening right now? And I'd heard stories about other journalists, specifically journalists from Minneapolis, getting called out to Paisley Park when Prince was unhappy with them. So I started kind of doing this mini panic attack, but before too long, we were welcomed into the building. We were brought into the NPG Music Club room, which is like the smaller cabaret style room where Prince hosted parties. And I'd been, you know, to that room before to see him. And he came right out and walked right up to us and put out his hand. And I just blurted out, "Hi, I'm Andrea Swenson." And he just looked at me like, "I know, I summoned you here, clearly." But we had, you know, just a unforgettable evening together. We spent some time in his studio. He was about to release a couple of new albums that fall, one with his new band Third Eye Girl and a new solo album, Artificial Age. So we listened to tracks from both of those, talked for quite a long time. He walked me kind of up and down the hallway to the studio, so we had time to just kind of chat and almost get like a mini tour of the space. And he told me some stories about, you know, things as we were walking by. And it was just incredibly disarming. You know, when you are in a setting where you are meeting one-on-one with him, he was so calm and down to earth and charming. And I could tell that he was used to needing to put other people at ease, you know, people that were suddenly found themselves there.
You and Bobby said you may have struck a nerve. Did he ever bring up the blog and what in it that caught his eye?
He made one comment as we were going down the hallway, and he kind of did it in this funny little sing-song voice. And he was like, "Bobby, remember when we were in high school together?" And it was pretty clear that he did not enjoy, you know, these retrospective type articles and pieces about him. And then he turned back and looked me right in the eye and said, "This is what I'm doing now." And that's when he swung the door open to the studio and started playing me the new music. So I think he was honestly making a point to both of us, both Bobby and me, that yes, Purple Rain is great and, you know, celebrate it all you want, but he is this artist that is constantly on to the next thing. And he was now 30 years and more than 30 albums, you know, away from where he was when that movie and soundtrack came out. And point taken, Prince.
Did you get to shoot hoops with him? He's quite the, was quite the basketball player.
No, no, my kind of funny interaction with him was actually, we were back in the NPG Music Club room and chatting, and I think he was kind of getting ready to wrap up the conversation and call it a night. So he stuck out his hand and there was some live music playing. He had a house band going and he looked at me and he said, "Do you want to dance?" And I went completely beat red, like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what is happening right now?" And before I could do anything, he whipped his hand away and slapped it on his leg and said, "Just kidding." And then he did it again. "No, really, do you want to dance?" And then, like, before I could do anything again, "Just kidding." And then he ran this, like, little mini lap around Bobby and I, just laughing like a kid. And Bobby turned to me and said, "I think you have a new friend."
We are talking with Andrea Swenson. We'll talk more about Prince later in the interview here on Rock Conversations. But Andrea, among other things, is the author of the book, Gotta Be Something Here, The Rise of the Minneapolis Sound. What exactly is the Minneapolis sound, and how would you describe it?
So there's a couple ways that I think about it. There's the technical, you know, music critic description of it, which is it's this amalgamation of genres that hadn't been put together in quite this way before, combining soul and R&B and funk with new wave and punk and some of these newer elements that were emerging, combined with classic rock, which Prince was very much steeped in as he was coming up in Minneapolis. But I like to think of it more philosophically, because in order to really understand the sound and how it came to be, I think you really need to understand the social and political history of Minneapolis and this environment that it came out of. This place, you know, was and continues to be deeply segregated. We're dealing with huge racial divides and divisions. And Prince and his peers were acutely aware of this, the fact that the people that they came up around, their parents who were musicians, their mentors, faced incredible discrimination because they were Black. And in order to fight against that, they knew that they had to strategize and have bands that had mixed race lineups and create music that could appeal to all people so that they could get out of this community that was consistently sidelined by the larger white culture here. So I think that is just such a core element of it, too. It's about combining people and communities and scenes in this way that Minnesota hadn't seen before, that we wanted to bring together all of these different kinds of audiences and get to celebrate all together in a place like First Avenue and all these places that, you know, Prince and his friends came up in.
Well, you bring up First Avenue and you kind of beat me to the punch because I was doing a little research, and please let me underline little because I never want to be accused of doing too much research. But I'm going to talk to Steve McClellan, longtime GM at First Avenue, for one of our podcasts in the next few days. And in doing this research, I saw a clip of him, a video clip where he didn't really know the unwritten rule about not booking Black artists at First Avenue. And the police apparently told him in no uncertain terms, we're not going to really be here to protect you if you do that. I'm sure you're well aware of those stories. And certainly it was not unique to him or First Avenue. There were other clubs that kind of bucked the trend, if you will, and bucked the system.
Absolutely. And you know what makes First Avenue unique in that instance is that they actually were able to stay in business, because unfortunately the other clubs that did try to book more Black bands and draw more mixed audiences in downtown were all shut down within months and sometimes just a couple of years of opening. I've talked to Steve about this too, and he was very much unaware at the time and has become very aware now. And he made a really interesting comment to me after my book came out. We were talking about it, and he said, I just didn't know that this whole other community was, you know, behind Prince. We saw Prince, we saw Jimmy and Terry emerge, but there was such a separation between, you know, the white punk rock scene that was exploding in the 7th Street entry and, you know, Jimmy and Terry's dance nights at the Taste Show Lounge just a few blocks away. It was so divided that even someone as, you know, embedded in the scene as Steve McClellan didn't know that this whole community of musicians was there and that they were so talented and worth, you know, the same amount of time and resources and attention. So I think it really speaks to just how, unfortunately, you know, there have been these bubbles created in Minnesota where you can live here and just be so unaware of other people that also live here.
It was interesting because, and I don't mean to sound like I'm name dropping, but Neil Carlin, who you might know, the author and Prince confidant, as much as anyone can be a confidant, right, with Prince. He talks about meeting Prince without even knowing it years ago, because Neil's grandparents were living on the north side. They were immigrant Jews, and they were one of the last to hold on. I think his grandma said, hey, we traipsed across Siberia. We're not moving now that we're in Minneapolis. But there was a time before the mid-60s where the two cultures and the two communities really coexisted well, and then they didn't so much. There was white flight. What I'm getting at is, in your research for the book, what did you find, or how did this inspire people like Prince and other musicians to see their neighborhoods change, to see Highway 55 put up on one end and divided, 94 on the other side and divided? How did that really impact their life and maybe their musical inspirations?
There's a somewhat famous quote from Prince about his experience growing up in Minneapolis, where he said, you know, I came from this Black and white world, I experienced the inequality and the equality, the rich and the poor. And he found that experience to be incredibly insightful and valuable to him, a real formative environment to grow up in, because he was able to have this real worldly approach from a very young age. And he also was bused to different schools. Some voluntarily, his parents opted in to do that, and some part of this integration program that the Minneapolis School District was doing. So he literally would, you know, get on a bus in North Minneapolis, leave the predominantly, you know, Black and Jewish neighborhood, drive around Lake of the Isles, go to Kenwood Elementary School. And that was in fifth grade, you know, so he was seeing this is a city where you can go a mile and your environment completely changes. So I know that he valued that. I know that, you know, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis have both said that being so familiar with South Minneapolis and that neighborhood and the diversity and the beautiful, you know, gathering of so many different kinds of communities in that area were really formative to them. So again, it just gets to my maybe a little highfalutin but kind of philosophical interpretation of, like, this is the core of the Minneapolis sound, is being able to, integrate these communities that previously had been so separated.
What's interesting is that, or at least interesting to me, maybe you as well, maybe others, is I think it's fair to say the two most famous musicians to come out of Minnesota are Bob Dylan and Prince. Feel free to disagree, but Dylan made a quick stop here, freshman year, which I don't even think he really completed, spent some time in Dingytown, and then needed to get away to become Bob Dylan, as we know him. Went to New York, obviously. Prince thought he needed to get away, went to New York, and ended up back in Minnesota for the majority of his life. Very interesting when you think about it.
Totally. Yeah. Prince actually got that first call from his first manager while he was in New York, trying to shop himself to labels, which didn't go very well. And Owen Husney was here and had just heard his demo tape and was so excited about this new artist. I think it's a little ironic, as you say, that he had to fly home then to really have that first taste of success. And he has so many quotes that he's given throughout the years about how much he valued Minnesota as well, and that he could be famous here and still be left alone and respected and not treated like a paparazzi chased peacock, as they like to do to celebrities out in LA. And then Dylan, on the other hand, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but one of his most critically received albums was actually recorded back here in Minnesota, Blood on the Tracks, in 1975. He came back here and he set up shop at Sound 80, and he re-recorded the songs that he didn't like that he had tried to record out in New York. And it was here with Minneapolis musicians that he tapped into this beautiful arrangement and sound that's now so iconic and so closely associated with him. And I find it so interesting that within a year, Prince was also in that same space making his debut album, to think about what would have happened if they had passed in those halls. I don't know if they ever met face to face and had a conversation. I cannot really imagine it, because they both have such distinct personalities, and it would be very interesting to see that kind of interaction. They would each say one line that said so much.
We are talking with Andrea Swenson on Rock Conversations. She, as I mentioned earlier, is the author of a very good book, Got to Be Something Here, The Rise of the Minneapolis Sound. You're also a former DJ at The Current here in the Twin Cities. Speaking of DJs, one of the focuses of Rock Conversations is to talk with both current and, more often than not, former FM DJs, including some from KQ. And you mentioned how Prince was influenced, and I found this very unique. I for some reason, I didn't think that he would have been a KQ listener back in the day. When I say back in the day, we're talking late 60s, early 70s, when it was still arguably freeform radio. What influence did that have on him, and what did you learn when you looked into that that aspect of his life?
Oh, so huge. I actually got a chance to talk to him about that when we met, and he reiterated again the reason why KQ was such a draw for him and all of the friends that he grew up with, like Andre Simone and like Jimmy and Terry, is because there was only one radio station in the Twin Cities that played R&B and funk music, and they only played it for a few hours a day on this AM station that was based actually in Golden Valley, but you could pick it up in North Minneapolis. So it was basically from something like 1 to 6 p.m., you could hear that kind of music in this 1 mile radius of this little community radio station. Otherwise, there wasn't a lot of that style of music. But on KQ, there weren't the same boundaries that you might find on more like top 40 radio stations. Like you mentioned, it was extremely eclectic in the 70s. And that was what opened, Prince and his friends' eyes to Joni Mitchell. Maria Muldaur was another big influence of his when he was in high school, and his favorite band was Grand Funk Railroad. And there was just something about that specific period of classic rock and how experimental it was and how genreless in some ways it was that just hit him at the right time and age. And he was still talking about it, all these years later, as being something that was so formative.
As we talk about radio, it's somewhat ironic. Isn't music full of ironies when you think of it? Not only ironic, but kind of sad that Twin Cities radio stations were really, really slow. I don't even want to say to embrace Prince, but to play him a little. stations throughout the country were doing it. But here in his hometown, do you think it was a resistance to the hometown boy, the prophet who maybe wasn't heard at home, or was it something deeper than that?
I think it was deeper, and it was something that Prince was very aware of, because at the time, you know, when he was signed to Warner Brothers, they still marketed black artists differently. It was a different division. You had a different publicist. They were working different radio stations. You were playing different clubs. And Prince was, you know, from a very early point, embraced by black audiences and beloved by these black audiences. Detroit was one of his biggest cities to become like Prince Superfan Central. But in Minnesota, we just didn't have that same kind of radio station. It just didn't exist yet. So I think it might not even have been about him being a hometown artist. I think it was that at that time, the music industry wasn't ready to perceive him as a pop artist, which is, you know, how he wanted to be perceived. He didn't want to be an R&B radio artist, and it took a while for that to happen. It wasn't until 1999, the quote-unquote crossover album from his career, that finally the Twin Cities started playing Little Red Corvette, and that was kind of that moment where it really took off. And I actually got a chance to interview most of his band from that 1999 tour for the podcast that I work on with the Prince Estate, and they said that they could see night after night the ratio of black to white people was changing rapidly. It started with like 80% black clientele in the audience, and by the end it was 80% white. And you could see the success of Little Red Corvette as Prince was just suddenly catapulted to become this mainstream artist. So I think it had a little bit more to do with just where he was positioned in the overall industry, and then just how overwhelmingly white it was here in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, as we're talking, I'm trying to remember. I pride myself on having a very sharp memory. In this case, I have zero memory. But honestly, can't remember the first time I was really introduced to Prince. Now, regular listeners of our podcast know that I'm from Winona originally. I don't say grew up there because I'm not sure I've grown up yet. But, you know, I think it was friends who probably introduced. We didn't have a radio station. You know, we weren't getting the Twin City stations too often. It probably would not have mattered. We got some from La Crosse, Wisconsin. And the ones in Winona, trust me, were not playing Prince. So I think it was probably friends and or MTV that really exposed my friends and me to Prince, certainly the more the mainstream side of him, if you want to call it that, mid to later 80s, but very interesting. Now, the flip side, as we're talking about a lack of radio play for Prince at that time, you had this song called Funky Town, which yes, everyone knows. You can't get it out of your head if you start singing it. It was Steven Greenberg, or as his friends call him, Stevie, I think. My friend Stevie Greenberg, I'm not close friends with him, so I can't claim that, but he really he revolutionized, or at least took the Minneapolis sound to a whole nother level. And I think it kind of irked Prince a little bit, didn't it? I realize we don't have to focus completely on Prince, but these two were connected for sure, interlaced.
Well, I think it irked more than just Prince. I mean, that was, you know, the biggest thing to happen to the metro area music scene since probably Surfin' Bird, or probably even bigger than Surfin' Bird, you know, in the 60s, the success of the Trashmen. I mean, that was the biggest thing to happen, at least since the success of Surfin' Bird, the Trashmen hit, probably, you know, went on to become an even bigger song than that. Both of them still to this day you can hear occasionally in commercials and movies and things. But yeah, I found a quote from Owen Husney, and I've asked him about this. Prince's first manager said that it definitely lit some kind of fire under Prince to see such a runaway hit. And the fact also that it was sung by one of Prince's peers who he came up alongside in the North Minneapolis scene, Cynthia Johnson. But when the song was marketed, she was not really part of that visual representation, or really, she was part of the live band, but, you know, once there were videos made and things, she was kind of sidelined. So I think he saw that too and saw, well, here's a white artist who's taking our sound and making it pop, but the black artists aren't actually involved in the conversation or able to really benefit from it in the same way. And I think it added a little bit more to that fire of, you know, I need to strategize here and figure out how to break down some of these barriers in the industry.
Have you talked to Steven Greenberg about it in the years that followed? And what are his reactions? Is he super proud? Is he a little tired of it? Is it a combination, or does he just count the royalty checks?
He's extremely proud of that song, to the point that he actually sent me just a maybe a year ago, he continues to rewrite it and re-record it in different versions so that it can be used in soundtracks and things. And he actually wrote like a new 30-second outro to the song that he just felt like it needed for whatever reason. So he's thinking about it a lot. It's funny, one of my good friends actually got really mad at me when I interviewed Steven Greenberg for The Current because he revealed that Funky Town was not, in fact, written about Minneapolis. He's not talking about Minneapolis being this cool place that you want to go to. He's talking about feeling the need to flee Minneapolis because he saw it as a quote-unquote vanilla market, to get back to what we were saying about the overwhelmingly white radio stations here. And he was imagining someplace like New York, you know, a more eclectic kind of bohemian mix of people and cultures. So he's very proud of the song, but it also addresses some of that same tension that we've been talking about today, which is that, you know, unfortunately, only certain artists were prioritized in the early days of this scene.
We're talking with Andrea Swenson, a Twin Cities music expert. I think I can call you that for sure. Got to be something here. The Rise of the Minneapolis Sound is the title of your book. You're a former DJ at The Current. You are the host of the official Prince podcast, which I want to talk about in a little bit. But I would like to go back for just a second or two to First Avenue. I want to look at some of the bands that kind of predated my time, but I've become big fans of since, predated only by a few years. I'm not that young, a little old, but bands like Husker Du, The Replacements, and then later Soul Asylum. How did they incorporate, if at all, in your opinion, the Minneapolis sound into their music?
Well, that's such an interesting question because, you know, by the time you got to the early to mid 80s, there were two predominant Minneapolis sounds. And that term, Minneapolis sound, gets associated with Prince and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and even Janet Jackson, you know, her work with Jam and Lewis. But the punk scene that came out of here in the early 80s was just as influential on the national scene. And, you know, still to this day, alternative rock artists are still citing, you know, the effect of Husker Du and The Replacements on their work. So it's interesting that, you know, maybe it also kind of illustrates a little bit of that divide, but that there were these kind of two dueling scenes. And I really like to visualize, you know, what a night would have been like at First Avenue with someone like Husker Du in the entry and someone like Prince on the main room stage, because that really is Minneapolis, that, you know, wide array of sounds and scenes and people coming out to just experience music and not necessarily like one particular genre.
I think you alluded to it earlier, maybe stated more pointedly, that there were different types of crowds. You know, you could have one in 7th Street entry and another one in the main room. Today, do you think those crowds, if you have the same types of artists, Husker Du in the main room and maybe, well, obviously we're not going to have Prince, but maybe someone else, you take your pick, in the main room, would there be an overlap of an audience? Do you think the audiences have aged and evolved to the point where they can appreciate and would like to hear both?
I found, going out to a lot of shows, that if something is Prince adjacent, like one of his collaborators, someone that's similar to that style, the audience is very eclectic and mixed. But unfortunately, we're still struggling to find that kind of balance in the rock world. It's still very white. And I think there's been some headway in recent years with, you know, a bigger variety of artists coming up and wanting to play in that genre. But it's, unfortunately, I wish I could say that it is better. It's not. it's completely, you know, commonplace to go to the main room and see 95% white people at a rock show. And I hope that can change. Similar to the hip hop shows, you know, for some of the more successful hip hop artists that have come up in Minnesota, they're playing to predominantly white artists, even though this is a black art form. So we have work to do in that regard, I think, in terms of not just what kind of music is being made, but who's being welcomed into these spaces. And that's actually a conversation that's going on right now among a lot of these venues is, you know, we've had this time off with the pandemic, with everything closed down, to really think about this, like what could we be doing better to make sure that people feel welcome in these spaces and that they are safe spaces for, you know, a variety of people, particularly, you know, of these marginalized backgrounds that experience abuse.
One more, I think just one more question about First Avenue, both in terms of what you've witnessed and experienced in your lifetime, as well as based on the research that you've done related to First Avenue. I'm the master of asking unfair questions, so I will ask one. What's its charm? What's its place in history?
Well, it has a couple things going for it. It's the longest running, I think outside of maybe one other venue in the country, independent rock club. And it has resisted the pull of Live Nation taking over, AEG taking over so many of these spaces. It's survived bankruptcy and come back from the ashes, you know, multiple times at this point. There's something enduring about it, and it has such a loyal following because people in the Twin Cities really value it as an institution. And I don't think you see that in a lot of other places, that a building is so beloved as if it's like a person that is part of this community. And then, you know, it's just, there's something about it that's just cool. You know, it used to be a bus depot. It still has the checked floor. It has like 8 million layers of black paint covering everything. So you feel like you can sense the history and the fact that so many different people have traipsed through there and seen so many different kinds of music. It just feels like a living part of our past and also kind of an exciting part of our present.
It's been a long time since I've been there, but where else can you get a hard plastic cup or glass of beer? I guess it'd right. be kind of a contradiction to call it a glass if it's hard plastic, but that was one of my fond memories from the many Warren Zevon concerts I've seen there over the years. You, as we mentioned earlier, are the host of the official Prince podcast. Tell us a little more how that came about and where you are now with the episodes.
Well, I think it all started that night when I met Prince, and even a little bit before then when we had started kind of corresponding through his people. There was a relationship there that was nurtured on both sides from his camp and also me and my colleagues at The Current. So when he passed away, there was a conversation about how can we keep this relationship going. We both really valued that and wanted to continue celebrating him and playing such a wide variety of his music, not just the hits, but exploring all the different eras of his career. So that kind of evolved over time into this conversation of, well, what if we made a podcast? And, you know, they've been really putting a lot of effort into highly curated releases around particular albums. So we've done podcasts about 1999 and Sign of the Times. Both of those got reissued in these huge box sets with tons of alt materials. You can hear, you know, other things Prince was doing. And now you froze. Oh, you're back. Okay. Sorry. I'll try to pick up right in the middle of there. So they've been putting out these huge, you know, box sets celebrating the albums and also including all of this vault material from Prince that really illustrates kind of where he was at in his creative process around the time of 1999 and Sign of the Times. And it's just the perfect content for a podcast, if you ask me, because you get to have this entry point where people know that they love these iconic albums, but you're also offering them kind of a behind the scenes into the vault peek at all of this work that Prince made that he archived and never released. So it has this kind of natural like curiosity about it. And the people that have participated in the podcast have just been so wonderful and supportive as well. I've gotten a chance to interview so many of Prince's collaborators now. And I think they also appreciate the fact that they can tell their stories and have them archived and documented along with these releases, you know, so that it becomes, almost like an archive in and of itself, the podcast, where you're hearing people that were in the room with Prince when these things were happening, and they can bring you right there alongside them and tell you what they saw and how it felt and what it meant to them and to Prince. And it's just been such a joy to work on this. I geek out on it so hard. I get in these like rabbit holes where I'm just thinking only about, you know, this 6 month period of Prince's life for months on end. And it's really fun.
Any other new projects in the offing that you can share with us?
Well, there's a new season of the podcast that will come out in July. The Prince Estate is, for the first time, releasing a full vault album. So an album that Prince recorded, mixed, mastered, and then didn't release in 2010 called Welcome to America. And that's been really interesting because it's a period where, you know, I was covering Prince. This is a more recent period of his life. I know a lot of the people that he was working with, and it's easier in some ways to document because people are, you know, just pulling up their emails like, oh, let me see what day I flew into Paisley Park and that kind of thing. So that's been really fun. And then I am just beginning work on my next two books, actually. One will be about one particular artist in Minnesota that I can't quite divulge yet because we haven't done all the paperwork and things, but it's a biography of a legendary artist from here. And then the other one is going to be a more wide-ranging history of women in the early rock scene in Minnesota, because there's some just phenomenal all-women groups that were real pioneers in the genre back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. And they just haven't gotten their due in the same way that, you know, the replacements of the world have. So I really just want their stories to be told. And I'm sure we'll have a big, fun concert, you know, when the book comes out. And who knows, maybe I'll even figure out a way to release some of this music that's kind of out of print.
Fantastic. Speaking of books, let's throw in one more mention. Your book, the one that is in publication, is Got to Be Something Here, The Rise of the Minneapolis Sound. You are Andrea Swenson. It's been great chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. This has been a blast.